reconvene our meeting, and I'm going to ask Regent Henson to introduce our students.
Well, Chair Bellows, because I'm always calling for Regent Ridley, I would like to acknowledge Mr. Anthony Gilbert, who got the lawnmower stuff.
I thanked him in the bathroom. Yeah. All right. Regent Henson.
Oh, you're waiting.
Well, I think we'll go ahead.
Okay. All right, guys. What a great day to be a Hilltopper. Could we not have better weather? Look at this. And Dr. Cavani, it's all an honor of you. They decide they have sunshine and warm weather in today's celebration. And if you haven't got your M&Ms, come see me. They have a very nice feature on them. They have WKU, Big Red, Go Tops, and they have Dr. Cavani's head on M&M's, so on the red and white color. So if you'd like a bag of M&M's, please see me. This is what I do in my spare time when I'm on conference calls at my office, when they take on and on and on, I start shopping. So you are the benefit of this lovely shopping, and since we're celebrating everything today, it is my honor to get to introduce Audra Jennings from the Office of Scholar Development. She's going to introduce you to some of our students that are over the top. These students need to be recognized.
So thank you so much. I want to just briefly contextualize the students, the success of the students I plan to introduce today. So last year, WKU students and recent graduates earned recognition in national scholarship competitions 74 times, earning over $470,000 in those competitions. This year, WKU students and recent graduates submitted 223 applications for nationally competitive scholarships, up from 180. Last year. And so far this year, our applicants have earned recognition 74 times already, and we're still waiting on additional news, and they have won over $660,000. So we have had some really tremendous success, including a few very big firsts for WKU. Because we're still waiting on announcements for this cycle, I haven't yet contacted Institutional Research to give you some data about this year's class. So I want to just briefly tell you a little bit about the students who won scholarships last year. So 42% of those students received Pell Grants, of those students who won national scholarships at WKU. 19% of our winners last year were students of color. 22% were first-generation college students. And 38% were not students in the Honors College. So very diverse group last year and this year as well. So it is now my great pleasure to introduce you to a few of this year's National Scholarship recipients. And so I'll have students come over when I call their name and stay up here with me. So Dana Beakley-Spiesel has been selected as an NSF Graduate Research Fellow. The fellowship will provide a $34,000 a year stipend and a cost of education allowance for up to 3 years, as well as numerous professional development opportunities if Dana pursues graduate studies at the Scripps Research Institute. During her time at WKU, she studied chemistry and Chinese and worked on several research projects, most recently with Dr. Zhang in the chemistry department. She is a past recipient of the Environmental Protection Agency Greater Research Opportunities Fellowship. A little bit of a mouthful there. A participant in an NSF International Research Experience for Students in South Korea, and a graduate of the Gatton Academy. She is from Grayson. Andy Dahmer. Andy Dahmer has been named a 2018 Harry S. Truman Scholar, WKU's first recipient of this prestigious award, which will provide $30,000 for graduate school and numerous professional development opportunities, including a fully funded government or nonprofit internship in the DC area, assistance with graduate school applications, and educational opportunities to support her ambitions for a career in public service. She's one of just 59 juniors across the nation to be selected for this honor. As you're aware of in Andy's work as student regent and student body president, I want to highlight her involvement in undergraduate research. Her research focuses on diplomatic recognition of Taiwan in Latin America, and she has published 3 articles with Dr. Rich in the political science department. She's from Fisherville. Hayden Grace. Hayden was selected as a Wrangell Scholar. He is from Hawkinsville and studies mathematical economics. Last summer, he studied abroad at the University of Exeter through the Fulbright UK Summer Institute program. Hayden will enroll in foreign policy classes at Howard University this summer, participate in professional development activities to prepare for an international affairs career, and will receive a $3,200 scholarship through the Charles B. Rangel Summer Enrichment Program. Isaac Keller is a first-year student in political science from Kansas City, Missouri, and a member of WKU's National Champion Forensics Team. He was among approximately 5% of applicants nationwide to be selected in the Fulbright UK Summer Institute at Aberystwyth University in Wales, where he will study nationhood and identity. The Fulbright UK Summer Institutes are fully funded summer study at one of 10 locations throughout the United Kingdom. Jeremy McFarland received a Benjamin A. Gilman International Scholarship to fund his study abroad program and internship in Beijing this summer. Jeremy is from Campbellsville, studies Chinese and English, and is involved in Bowling Green Fairness. The Gilman Scholarship provides up to $8,000 for students with limited financial means to study abroad. Lauren Peterson. Lauren is of Barbersville. She was named a Barry M. Goldwater Scholar. The scholarship honors outstanding STEM students who aspire to research careers and provides up to $15,000 for undergraduate studies. Lauren, the only Kentuckian honored as a Goldwater Scholar this year, studies biology and chemistry and is a graduate of the Gatton Academy. She conducted extensive research with Dr. Norman in the Department of Psychological Sciences, studying the effects of aging on sensory perception. She has co-authored 5 articles in scientific journals. Nathan Reed is a fourth-year student in economics, international affairs, and Asian religions and cultures from Belleville, Illinois. This fall, he will begin his Chinese flagship capstone year in Nanjing, funded by a foreign scholarship. Foreign scholarships of up to $20,000 are funded by the U.S. Department of Defense and designed to promote American undergraduates' linguistic and cultural proficiency in world regions critical to the U.S. interests. Devin Richardson was selected as a Rangel Scholar. He is from Bowling Green and studies political science and international affairs. He studied abroad in Japan last summer on a Gilman scholarship and also received a critical language scholarship to study Japanese intensively this summer. Devin will enroll in foreign policy classes at Howard this summer, participate in professional development activities to prepare for an international affairs career, and will receive a $3,200 scholarship through the Charles B. Rangel Summer Enrichment Program. Maggie Sullivan is a graduating senior in international affairs from Louisville. Among many other activities, she has interned for the U.S. Department of State since 2016. Last summer, she completed a placement in the Office of Refugee Admissions in the Bureau of Populations, Refugee, and Migration. She will spend this summer at the U.S. Embassy in Bosnia before beginning a Fulbright English teaching assistantship in Bulgaria in the fall. Ruben Tang is one of 100 students nationwide to receive a Funds for Education Abroad scholarship, which will support his study abroad program in Taiwan, where he will intensively study Mandarin Chinese. Ruben is from Glasgow, studies architectural science and Asian religions and cultures, and is involved in the Pinyo Project. The Fund for Education Abroad is a nonprofit organization that aims to increase participation among students underrepresented.
Thank you all. Would any of my committee like to say anything?
Andy, Kim,
or George? I just think it's awesome that they're here, and I'm glad I didn't go to school with any of you. Really? Feel like a slacker compared to what you have done. But I'm thrilled that you're going on to represent Western Kentucky University, yourselves and your community. So thank you very much.
I'm just wild. Y'all are amazing students, and you're doing some amazing things. And I know that you will leave here and one day go off and do greater things. But very impressive group. Congratulations.
Well, as a committee member and recipient, I would like to say that I'm really grateful to OSD for all that they do for such a variety of students. And I think that it would be even better if we can incorporate the things that OSD does into the lives of all students, especially encourage more students to work with OSD, because it's truly, it's not segmented by honors or a specific demographic of students. Everyone can work with them and really achieve their dreams. So I'm grateful that they were a part of my experience here at Western.
Thank you, Annie. Congratulations, you all. You all are quite impressive. We're very proud of you and so glad you're Hilltoppers.
Could we have the student that is doing study on sensory deficits
yes.
Older people?
I'd also like to add my congratulations and great pride in these students' individual accomplishments, and also to thank Audra for the work that she does individually, not just with these representative students, but the students across the university who take advantage of the services that the Office of Scholar Development offers. And so what I want to point out is the number of students among this group who are the first in their families to get a college degree, who aren't members of the Honors College but have taken advantage of this. And there is no better example of the fact that this institution remains an institution of opportunity and access, but also the great effect and the transformation of lives that we engage in every single day. So congratulations.
I don't know how this would work, but it would be great if somehow or another we could advise alumni in the areas that you all are relocating to that you're there. For example, the two of you who go out on the Wrangell Scholars, I'm on the Hill a lot. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. So it's always nice to know I got somebody that I get in trouble, I meet up, I can make a phone call. And so I think it would be great if we could somehow or another let alumni in case you need something, and also allow you to connect, because I'd like to follow up with all of you all that are in Washington. And I didn't, it's working at the State Department. It would be great, to have dedicated folks there that know about. So somehow know that we can figure out how to make that connection.
We'll work on that.
Regent Nichols is hosting an event, a WKU event in D.C. June 13th.
I should come over to the house.
June 18th, man.
We'll
be a little bit late.
Okay. We'll have you over anyway.
Right. Thank you all for taking time out to come and allow us to be introduced to you all. I'm just so impressed. And I thank you, Tom and Bale, for letting me be chair of the best committee there is. But how positive this is to be able to recognize students like this, and it's quite an honor to be a chair of this committee. Thank you all.
That concludes.
Thank you, Dr. Bailey. That concludes the student affairs. I'm so excited about this meeting. Thank you. That concludes the student affairs committee report.
All right. We will move next into the academic affairs committee and Regent Ridley.
Dear Mr. Chairman Bale, I did want to point out that our agenda is 1/3 less than it originally planned for, so we want to be accredited to the division.
So AA1 has been removed from our action items, so we have two action items, AA2 and AA3, and today we are being presented to who's on his swan song here, but we appreciate his leadership and all that he has done for our university, not just for the years, but through this period of transition as in their department provost. So thank you, Dr. Lee, very much.
Thank you very much, Regent Ridley.
And you're a great historian, too.
Well, I have to say, it doesn't feel like I'm on a glide path yet.
No, you're not.
I haven't quite picked up that current. But I would like to preface my comments by two things, just real quickly. In terms of the students that we just met, Audra and her team just have a special talent. You see a lot of different kinds of distinctive teaching around this campus. She and her group have a special talent for helping students discover skills they probably didn't know they have, and the best way is to showcase those. Not everybody can do that sort of thing. That's a very special skill. And she has put that to work to the benefit of our students in particular. And you heard a passing reference to our forensics program. Just thought I'd mention that the forensics program ruled the world again at the National Forensics Association competition this past weekend, and we've come back again as national champions. That is something I get to say almost every year, and I never get tired of it. I'm delighted to have the chance to say that again. The next item on our agenda is the approval of an emeritus appointment, and this particular emeritus appointment is Dr. John Harden from the Department of History. John is a third-generation, I think John's back here trying to hide in the corner, but John's a third-generation Kentuckian. He has degrees from Bellarmine and from Fisk and the University of Michigan. He came to WKU as a member of the History Department in 1991, made full professor in 2009. He has served this university in a lot of different ways. He was assistant dean of Potter College for a while. He's been assistant to the provost for diversity enhancement. He has chaired the university disciplinary committee, which is no easy task under any circumstances. He has served as Kentucky African American Heritage Commission member. He served on the Kentucky Historical Society Board, and he is locally chair of the board of directors of the African American Museum here in the Bowling Green area. The thing I particularly want to emphasize for you all about John is that he has been a leader in capturing the story of African Americans in Kentucky. He has written the centennial history of Kentucky State University. He has written a history of the segregation era in Kentucky, a 50-year period in particular, published by the University Press of Kentucky. And perhaps at the most notable level, he is one of three co-chairs to undertake the enormous task of preparing the Kentucky Encyclopedia, the Kentucky African American Encyclopedia, which was published a few years ago by the University Press of Kentucky. That was a massive undertaking, and it brought together an enormous amount of information that would have been lost without the work that John provided so much valuable leadership for. I regret very much that John has moved to full retirement, but he has certainly earned it. And I guess I would like to invite you all to applaud John's work. John.
Can I entertain a motion?
So moved.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Okay. Very good.
Thank you, Rich. Those all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. And the motion passes, and we certainly thank you for your service and your contributions to our world and our society. It's extremely important of your life's work. We will not forget this. Thank you, sir.
And the next item on our agenda is your approval of an honorary doctorate be conferred on Bowling Green native Sam Bush. And I suspect all of you are familiar with Sam's work, Sam's incredible performance skills. He has been a definer in terms of bluegrass, bluegrass music, drawing on influences from a lot of different kinds of directions. He's been nominated 13 times for a Grammy. He's won three of them. He's been named Mandolin Player of the Year four times by the International Bluegrass Association. The American Music Association has given him a Lifetime Achievement Award for instrumentalism. He is somebody who has really changed the nature of music in a significant and important way. He's always maintained his roots here in Kentucky and specifically here in Bowling Green. But I think he is a very worthy recipient of an honorary doctorate. And I would also add that the notes for this meeting have been provided by Erica Brady, a faculty member in our Folk Studies program, who has hosted Barron River Breakdown for years and years, and she knows of what she speaks when she says Sam is a significant force in American music.
Do I hear a motion?
In a second.
Come on. Are there any further discussion? Not hearing any, I call for a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. And the motion passes. Gentlemen, that is the report from the academic committee.
All right. We will move directly into the executive committee meeting. We have a couple of action items. All members are present. And all members of the board here today. And the first item has to do with the new athletic contract for new coach for women's basketball. Todd, do you want to say anything?
Sure.
New coach.
our women's basketball program is in the best position it's ever in the generation. The last 6 years, 154 games, and we've been to the NCAA tournament for the last 5 years. We needed to lose Michelle Hurd, who was our coach, but a big reason why we had the success that we had was her associate head coach, Greg Collins. He was involved in every aspect of our program. So when Michelle left, it seemed logical to me to promote Greg to the head coach. Deep continuity, he has the respect of our players, and he's also been heavily involved in recruiting. Because of where our program is right now and the stature that it has and the way it's respected, not only in our conference, but nationwide, if you have a pay scale and the opportunities that Michelle enjoys, should be the same for Greg. And so the contract in front of you is the exact same contract that Michelle Hurd had, no more, but also no less. We respectfully requested you and little Greg to take over under the same terms that Michelle had.
Okay, do any members of the executive committee have any questions or comments? We have a contract for us. Does anyone else have any comments or questions?
I have a question. So you brought to us this year that there was a salary increase for the men's basketball coach, which was funded by private funds.
Right.
And if I would look at the rate of success, you know, the women's program has been successful quite consistently. And was it possible or would have been possible to do a similar thing for a women's coach?
We actually did that for the women's coach 3 years ago. The salary was $150 and elevated it by a third to $200. Doesn't mean we won't do it again, but we had done that. The other reason we did it for Rick Stansberry was at the time we did that, he was sixth in our conference in salary, and that moved him to second. The current women's basketball number of 200,000 is second in our conference.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you.
If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve the athletic employment contract with Coach Greg Collins.
So moved.
Second.
Motion and a second. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Item number two has to do with a memorandum of lease agreement with College Heights Foundation. I believe we have Donald Smith here today. Donald, any comments?
Thank you, Chairman Bale. My name is Donald Smith with the College Heights Foundation, and just to provide an update of why this is before you today, you might remember last summer we talked about a building project with the College Heights Foundation that we were getting ready to undertake. The opinion of probable cost for that construction project was about $1.6 million. As we got the estimates back, it exceeded $2 million, and we found out we could build a new building for about $1.7 million. So it did not make sense to renovate a building that was 50 years old that did not have the life structures and the infrastructure that we needed. So now the recommendation is to raise the current facility and build a new one in its place. This is all being done by private support. You all may remember we announced it at that meeting the lead donors, a gentleman by the name of Mr. Cliff Todd, a generous philanthropist. He's contributed over $2 million to the institution, provided a professorship in longevity and healthy living through the first round of Bucks for Brains money back in 1999, and also has also supported scholarships, the renovation of the President's House Fund, and now the foundation building. So as President Caboni and I discussed, we felt like the best opportunity would be to do a $1 land lease, and then the College Heights Foundation would build the building as a separate entity, as opposed to that having to go under the university structure. And we have all funding in place, private support. Some of them are being paid over a five-year period, so we will have a little bit of a bond issue that will be on the College Heights side that we secured last year at a 3% interest rate before the rates went up, and that will be paid off over that five-year period as pledges are paid off. So we ask for your all's agreement today to do a $1 land lease with the College Heights Foundation. You have a sheet in front of you, and this is the map. The new facility will look a little bit different than what the previous one was. For those that recall that facility, it used to be connected to the Craig Alumni Center, now the Craig Administration Center. That connector wing was torn down a couple of years ago. And so now with the new structure, it will face Colonnade Drive more as opposed to just being right behind the Craig Center to give some more space there. Deborah Wilkins has looked at the lease agreement. We're still trying to define exactly the footprint of the building. So we ask that that general area that's behind the Craig Center would be the $1 lease, and we'll refine that for you.
Yes.
Let me see if any of the executive committee members first would like to ask any questions, make any comments.
No, just go ahead.
Dom, so do we have the complete funding? I know you said we had some pledges, but do we have like possibly 50, 80% of the money in hand to be able to build this building?
Yeah, we're about 70% in hand right now. The rest of it will be financed, and then we'll pay that off over a period of time. The College Heights Foundation has also built up a reserve for that period. So, you know, 50 years or so, we've been putting a little bit of money aside, knowing that building's not going to last forever. When it was built in the late 60s, and Brian Russell, I think, is still here, and we've talked to the campus master plan as well as facilities. It was not built to be a 100-year building. 50-year building is what it was intended for.
It's the brick one, isn't it? I mean, the kind of ugly, the one that is not.
You're correct. That's appropriate.
I'm sorry. You know, when you drive to campus, I'll be honest with you, and you see that building, it always stuck out to me as a sore thumb because it just did not look like the grandeur of a lot of other things around here as well. But I just want to confirm that you have at least 70-75% of it already funded, and you have 5-year pledges to be able to pay the rest of it.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, do you expect to have cost overruns because the Hensons have never built anything or renovated anything? There has not been a major cost overrun.
Well, we're working with Planning, Design, and Construction and Ross Tarrant Architects out of Lexington, and that is something that we're going to continue to watch. Now, construction costs are going up right now. It's a prime market, and contractors have more work than what they can handle, so it's not a great environment for bidding, but we'll scale it back.
How long will it take for us to build this building?
So we're anticipated to break ground, assuming you all approve the one-year lease. We'll get the bids back this summer. We don't want to tear down the current facility until we know those bids are going to come in under budget. Break ground in August, and then we're looking at 11-month construction. So we would be in July, early part of August, heading into the 19th.
And where will your offices be?
We are currently located, because we thought we were going to renovate that building until these calls came back. We're in the Honors College and International Center on the third floor suite, and we will stay there until we move into the new facility.
And the $1 lease area is that little space up there that kind of has a, like a little...
Yeah, so the dotted line represents the footprint of the current building. The more solid structure will be the footprint of the new building, and so we'll define exactly what those lot lines are when we do the $1 lease, but we're still working with the architects right now to see what the footprint of the building is going to be.
And some of the issues with that building is it wasn't necessarily handicap accessible.
It is not. You can't enter that building from any direction handicap accessible. There's only restrooms on one floor, so we meet with a number of elderly individuals that are setting up scholarship funds that simply can't get into our building, or students that have any disabilities can't access this either. So this will all be addressed through the renovation.
I'd like to make a comment at the end.
Okay, anyone else? Andy?
My questions were also regarding ADA compliance, so.
Sure. One question, just given the current things, and I think I know the answer to this, and I'm sure you'll be able to answer it, but if y'all are currently housed in a fairly new, very nice building on campus, and you're being accommodated, is there a need to have this building? And I feel like there probably is, but you know, we've got it already. You're already there. You've already got a space. Do we need to spend that money?
There is, and we did a lot of due diligence as we were thinking about this. The renovation, if we proceeded with it before, was going to give us office space growth for about 3 people. And given the growth that we've had within the foundation and the current space that we're occupying, we're already maxed out. And so there would be no opportunity for growth. So as the College Heights Foundation is looking at a 100-year building in the future, this provides that. But also a number of departments on campus are clamoring for the space that we're currently in, too. So I'm sure David Lee is still here. We'll attest that he'll be glad when we can vacate that suite that we currently are in.
Anyone else?
Can you put a parking structure underneath and include more parking up
there? That would be ideal.
John?
I don't think that's in our budget right now.
Well, I have 2 comments. Number one, I think that I know Mr. Todd personally. He's been a friend of mine for over 25 years. And when I met him many years ago, I asked him why he was in Bowling Green, and he came to an auction. His reintroduction to Bowling Green was at an auction over Mr. O.B. Clark House. And he came to buy furniture, and when he left, he owned the property. And I asked him one time, why did he feel that it was important for him to come back and establish a presence in Bowling Green? And he said when he was in school, He lived underneath the barn, or pardon me, above the stable of the barn at the ag department, which used to sit right out here. And he said if he walked to town often, and when he passed by Mr. Clark's house, he felt like if he ever succeeded, he wanted to own property in Bowling Green. The reason I bring that story up is that is, again, what the spirit that makes the master, that there was a motivation that was created at this university for a successful life path. And once he received that successful life path, he understood his responsibility as an alumnus and also as a successful individual to give back to that same institution. And I don't want us to pass by or gloss over the fact that there are numerous people in our community that are constantly giving to this university for many, many important things. And that brings me to my second point, and I appreciate the word, are we going to build this building or are we going to be able to utilize the space? We need to remember that a private 501c3 corporation is not the university property. That is the property of those philanthropic givers that is guided by a board of trustees for the fiduciary responsibility of providing with the mission. And if WKU can have more of the College Heights, WKU Foundation, Hilltopper Athletic spirit, we won't have to depend on state funding. We wouldn't have to depend on budget cuts because there is that philanthropic interest out there. This is just one example of many, many people that have given to this university, but we do need to remember that the wonderful job that the College Heights Foundation does and their fiduciary group, as well as all our foundations, have established a wonderful legacy. I think it started in 1923. So for us to even, I know you're here to get our approval, but we should thank you for all that you do for this university, and I don't want us to pass by that opportunity to let everybody know that how important it is.
Mr. Chair, Mr. President,
I would like to echo Regent Ridley's sentiment, and the College Heights Foundation could locate its building anywhere it was interested in. And I'm both thankful and think symbolically it's important for us to remember the heritage of starting of that foundation with a $100 gift from a faculty member in 1923, and for us to have a place where students who are in need have a place to go to get assistance still. And what a great symbol from Mr. Todd and his investment, but for the entire institution, of a place that cares about its young people and provides a place for them to go get assistance. I can't tell you the number of stories I've heard about someone coming to see Dero Downing and him opening up his little box and writing a note on a card and helping that student out. We've got to make sure we remain true to that mission. I think this building will continue that.
Very good. With that, I'll entertain a motion.
I so move.
I have a motion and a second for approval to authorize a memorandum of lease agreement for $1 a year with College Heights Foundation. Further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Motion passes. Thank you, Donald. I know your grandfather would be proud of you today.
We appreciate everything that you all are doing, and I appreciate President Caboni's remarks. Last year, the College Heights Foundation gave away about $5.6 million in scholarships to more than 2,200 students. So, a lot of deserving students that are out there.
All right. We have an information item, which I will turn over to Ms. Rob Taylor, who is here to update us on some legislative matters.
You want the short version or the fast version? The short version or the long version?
Whatever you deem necessary.
Well, so the session is over. The governor's veto period has just ended yesterday. And I think we got pretty much everything we had anticipated as we head toward the end and all the vetoes. I will not go through all of that. Because it would take a while and it was confusing to say the least. So here are the highlights. The highlights, as you all already know, a 6.25% reduction to the state appropriation for higher ed overall. about 31 million of that went back into went back to higher ed to flow through the performance funding model. That is generally very good for us. Clearly, had we not lost the 6.25%, we would have been somewhat better off, but we'll break even. I kind of have to depend on Ann to confirm all the numbers, but we'll break about even with that. That's and there was, some of you might remember, and at one point there was equity funding that went in for WKU and NKU specifically. That money is going to flow through the performance fund. So instead of coming directly to our base budgets at WKU and NKU, it plussed up a little bit of what they were planning to do in the performance funding bill or in the performance funding model. So again, I think the general wisdom, if I understand Bob King and CPE, is that really is going to flow to us anyway, since it comes through it, because we'll take the first sort of part of the pie of the performance fund to get to the equity piece. So that was good news. The Kentucky Mezzanat was funded. You will remember the governor had eliminated that as part of the 70-plus programs that were slated for elimination. We successfully kept that in, so we're pretty happy about that. That's a major statewide initiative for us that would not likely have been able to continue had we not been able to do that. So quite frankly, there was unanimous support among legislators that we spoke with, and in many meetings, which is not always the way it works, but in many meetings, they brought it up to us before we ever had an opportunity to bring it up to them. One disappointment, the Gatton Academy was cut by 2%. They did a similar cut to the Craft Academy. About $75,000, Lynette is aware of that, obviously. And then I do want to just address this briefly because I think it's important. If I don't, I'm sure that President Cavani will. There was some language that was added in the bill related to tenure, and the chair of the Faculty Senate and I corresponded quite a bit during the last several weeks of the session as that language came about. We view the language regarding tenure, and what that essentially does is it says that if you eliminate academic programs, you can eliminate the tenured faculty that go along with them with 10 days' notice. We have our own set, I guess, of rules but AAUP guidelines that really sort of guide this for all of higher education. And we feel like the language in the budget bill, which only lasts for 2 years, is permissive and that we can continue and will continue to follow the AAUP guidelines and the appropriate process for how you eliminate any faculty members that go along with any programs that are eliminated. And I would kind of reference David Lee and President Cavani if you all want more information on how that works. But we feel like we're okay on that. And quite frankly, even in the discussion in the conference committee, Senator McDaniel, who was the primary author of that language in the Senate version of the bill, which is what ended up in the bill, he made sort of the same comment that he didn't call it permissive, but he also said we had our own, that we would follow our own processes. So one of the things that occurred sort of in the overnight, late night things on the budget, which were, we think, very helpful to us, but it was an effort to try and I guess maybe give us a reprieve for a year as they determine how to deal with that contingent, is they froze our KTRS, our KERS rates. So you all heard us talk about how our KERS rates were slated to go up to 83%. They're going to stay where they are for 1 year. Now, that is, you know, we have 1 year, and then they go back up to, I guess, 84%, 83%. So we've got a year to figure that out. And I think that the intention of the legislators who made the effort to do that, and again, I think that was leadership on both House and Senate, but I think their intention was to give a year to determine how to deal with higher ed. They didn't really deal with the higher ed cost issue. There was, again, the long version, a couple of different bills that tried to do that. In the end, we're going to have a kind of a 1 year to study it and figure it out thing. So we are hoping for some positive outcome there. We were really, really pleased to have the elimination of the 5.1% penalty that we pay to KTRS on all of our faculty and professional employees who opt to go into a private retirement system. that's an option that faculty and administrators have. That penalty was set to be in place till 2049, and they eliminated it beginning July 1. So that will create some savings, and I think figure that out as well. But that was a win, and that was a big win. Something that we had certainly lobbied for and had been asking for some time. I don't want to go into all the different things on pension. What I'll just say is that there weren't a whole lot of changes to existing employees in what they ended up doing. The biggest thing for us is on the horizon, and it's a little difficult at the moment to talk much about it because we don't really know, but Anne's probably over there going, don't say that. But one of the things that they did is in the pension bill is they will eliminate the subsidy for higher education in KTRS that we never see. It's just a general fund subsidy that goes to KTRS to cover sort of the gap between what K-12 pays and what higher ed pays and what the actual contributions need to be. So in 2020, they eliminate that for higher ed. That will effectively double what we pay in employer contributions to KTRS, and that is terrifying. So that's something that we still have to figure out and deal with, and I'm not sure very many legislators recognized that that was in there when they passed that pension bill. And at least some of the ones that I spoke with did not know that. And then finally, there was a statutory relief bill that was passed on the last day. We waited until midnight to ensure that the governor signed it or didn't sign it or vetoed it. He did sign it, so this is good. And this bill, House Bill 592, it covers a wide range of things. One that you all will probably appreciate is that it will now allow for video teleconferencing for our public meetings. When the primary location is noticed and the public can see and hear, you all can have meetings, and I believe including closed meetings by teleconference now. So that is very helpful, and I'm sure that y'all like that. It will also allow us to, George, that was just for you. That was for you. It allows to opt out of the State Fire and Tornado Fund, which some say will give us some savings. It will also allow some real property to be sold at fair market value. A couple of other things. There's one thing in there that is really the big price factor for us, and that is there was a statute early on after higher ed reform was passed in 97 that if you're an employee of any institution, you can go to another institution for free for 6 hours a semester. And I think we are one of the bigger providers of that. So we have a lot of employees at other institutions who come here for free. What this will do is we'll effectively eliminate that, and it leaves it to the institution to determine how you want to handle employee waivers. It does not affect, I'm going to look at you, Tim, it does not affect our waiver for our employees to go to our institution. It only affects those employees who go to another institution, but the savings for us is on the employees who are coming from other universities here. It is a pretty substantial amount of money. So that was another one of our wins. And then, again, to Regent Nichols, who is the big winner in this whole session, he was the first university board member to be confirmed, and I will tell you that the rest of them got confirmed by midnight on the final hours. So anyway, the big winner of the legislative session. So that's the highlights, I think. And there's probably a little bit more, but if there's anything more you want to kind of delve into, you might want to catch me later. But happy to answer your questions.
This subsidy you mentioned, which is going to be cut by 2020, this is only for KTRS. This is not for KERS.
Correct. So the general fund doesn't subsidize KERS. The general fund does subsidize KTRS. And I will tell you that we didn't really recognize that. We don't know that. There's no, I don't want to overuse the word transparency, but there's no transparency there that we would have even caught that language for one thing. because it's really, it's hard to even recognize that language, isn't it, Anne? Had the sponsor of the bill not pointed it out to me, I don't think anybody would have caught it. And so we met, bill sponsor met bill drafter and talked with them, and that was when Senate Bill 2, or Senate Bill 1, was kind of not long after that, Senate Bill 1 died, and then remember was resurrected and passed on the floor within about an hour. And so at that point, there's no time for anybody to read it or recognize all the various little things that are in there. But it is just a KTRS, and it's what is a general, there are two different systems. KTRS gets a general fund subsidy. It's a big amount of money, and it just kind of covers, you know, here's what K-12 and universities pay, here's the gap, and it covers the gap. So they will continue to pay the gap for K-12, but after 2020, they will not continue to pay the gap for universities.
And the real rate's doubled?
Anne will have to answer the effect of that. We're not sure.
I'll tell you that over the last few years, I thought, this is strange math to me. The KERS rate kept going up as we brought to you, and the proposal that it go to 83%, and yet we were paying, I don't know if it's 16-17% basically on KTRS, and we'd heard that there's an unfunded liability in both of them, both programs, and I thought, why is our KTRS rate not going up? And that was the answer. They had been subsidizing it directly into KT, as I couldn't figure out why we weren't seeing a comparable increase in both of them for the unfunded liability. So my understanding, Robin, is that this allows us to have the KTRS rate for this biennium, but the next legislative session, the pension issues, will be front and center again. That's where we should see a very large increase.
And Dr. Ernst, I would say that one of the we spoke with the bill, the Senate A&R chair, who's not the drafter of this pension legislation, but there was a lot of interconnected legislation. Very wacky kind of, you know, just lots of stuff that was moving all at once, and then suddenly it wasn't moving, and then all of a sudden it was all passed. But we met with the Senate A&R chair and talked to him about this specific provision. And again, sometimes they say, well, we're going to deal with that next time. So I really think the effect of pension stuff for universities and what they did here is we're going to push this down the road another year. We're going to push this down the road another 2 years. We've got the biennium to work with you and figure something out. So I think that's what... You know, I think that's where we are. I have the commitment of those folks with the Senate and our chair. The bill sponsor, the pension bill, not from there. Joe Bowen, he is not running again. But we've got some time to work on that. Just don't know what a solution is going to look like. But for us, we have to begin to plan, and that gives us some sense of what we're looking at. Yes, Richard.
I know you knew I was going to ask a question. Actually, it's more of a comment. I think we all should recognize, as we talk about these pension liabilities that are going forward, and whether they address now or whatever, we need to really know where the rubber is going to hit the road, and it's going to be in tuition increases. And these are not things that we're deciding today. These are decisions that are being made for us on being able to deliver a value proposition to a student to be able to get higher education. And we need to remember this as we elect our officials and we communicate with our officials that this needs to be addressed, and it doesn't need to be passed on to a tax to a student as the form of an increase in tuition. And I think that we should do everything that we can to support our legislators to get this thing corrected. So right now, it's a smoking gun all the time. And maybe we're not doing enough as collectively to communicate with those legislators to say, now's the time. We've got to get this done. So that's fine.
I do have a question. I guess it could be more related to CPE. But is there, I guess, any stop that is foreseeable in the future about further reductions? Because I know the models that they've given us have reduced it to around 27%. for what's actually being funded by the state per student. And I guess, is there a time when that could foreseeably be zero or like in the teens?
I wish I could tell you that. Obviously, what the state decides to do, usually they figure out what they need to fund, how much they have, and then what they're going to devote that to. And we tend to fall, you know, below K-12 education, so K-12 is going to get funded first. I think I might direct that a little bit more on the performance funding model, because I think maybe that's where the question is. The case we've tried to make is that no state has been successful paying their way to performance funding. And the performance funding model was never intended to be used for, you know, as cut the base of everybody and then put part of it back in. I mean, it kept about $25 million in higher ed funding and put it in the general fund. So we got about $31 million back of the total that they cut. And I say we, I mean higher ed. So 31 will go back of about 55, 54. 31 will go back into the performance funding model. The problem with that is that we had to lose money to get money back. Some institutions won't get money back. And so we'll continue to struggle, Andy. We will continue to struggle as a state. We will continue to struggle as institutions of higher education until we reverse that trend. And I've been doing this business for 18 years for WKU, and in more than half of those we have been in cut mode, not in addition. So it's been a challenge, and I do not foresee any time in the near future when we reverse that trend.
Thank you.
Can I go back to one thing? And I know it's a win for the university to be cut on. Being able to take classes at another university on tuition. But on the flip side, when we do have staff and I believe some faculty who take classes at other universities, it's disappointing for them. But also I'm concerned about some of the programs. I know in the doctoral program for education, there were several people enrolled in that program who worked at other universities and were taking classes here, and I don't know if that's going to have a negative impact. And I'm sure it'd be nominal. But
so I can't answer in any definitive, but I keep kind of looking back over at Ann. I can't answer that in the definitive. Let me tell you what I think will likely happen. I think anybody who's in a current program will likely be grandfathered into a current program. I can't. And I think each institution collectively wants to discuss how to manage this. The real challenge will be the KCTCS, who's you know, this whole thing was invented for the purpose of helping KCTCS get an educated workforce for teaching. That's why they did it back 10 years ago. So we'll have to deal with that, Tamla. We'll have to decide, and I think we want to kind of collectively decide how to address this. I know I've seen other institutions that assure their campus that it won't affect your ability to kind of at our campus as our employee, and we will do the same.
I know, because I've known the staff. I mean, when we first heard this, we were very disappointed in that. And then we found out that it came from CPE. It was actually driven by the universities themselves. Like, okay, that's interesting. But I understand.
The tuition waivers are just a cost center for us. And I mean, the idea is everybody, groups of people should be able to come for free, which is great if
you're going to
work, right? So we've been trying to whittle away at some of the tuition waivers over the year. We've been able to move some things to last dollar in, so that instead of you just come for free because you fit this set of circumstances in your life, you can come for free. Well, we've been able to do some things that allow it to be a last dollar in, so you at least have to do Pell and all that stuff, and then we just pay the last dollar in. I understand the concern there. It's a collective, and then I think each institution will have to decide how they want to handle both their own employees coming to their own institutions or their own employees going elsewhere. I don't know. I know the president's discussed a little bit, but I don't think any decisions have been made.
Yeah, I want to add to this. I mean, a win for the institution. Clearly, I've been contacted by pupils at the loss of a benefit, so it's kind of strange to say it's for the institution. And my question is are there ways we can resurrect that by making agreements with our co-institutions within the state?
There are, and so I'll talk. There have been only very preliminary conversations around what the effect of this is. My sense is this gives us the ability to say to our employees, here's a benefit that we're going to offer to you, instead of us telling other institutions, here's a benefit you're going to give to our employees. And so it's a shift in the way, it gives us control over the way in which we can reward our own employees. It also allows us to create partnerships with other institutions that say, either capping it or this is the number of folks that we'll want. Because here's the example. Think about this in the context of a budget model we were just discussing. If we have a program where half of the students are paying zero in tuition, how viable is that program? Or how poor is it? And how do the dollars flow? And so I think this will get us some more clarity. At the same time, we know we want to be good partners, both with our community college or other institutions across the state, to grow our talent pool. And that's really important for the state. And so I have no doubt that the outcome of this will be that we will continue to have tuition remission available for our employees here and other institutions, and that we'll do that in a way that benefits those staff and faculty members.
Okay. Like one more comment because of the... It's my last one, I promise. But as a faculty member who's tenured, of course, tenure is of a great concern, and I just want to make you all aware of that we as an institution are sort of borderline competitive in the sense of the salaries we can pay, and having weaker tenure requirements does not help this recruiting effort or talent, and so there has been a great deal of concern on the faculty side in terms of how that will impact us. And as a final statement on this, I believe that if we have a program and we have students in the program, that we have an obligation by SACS that these students ought to graduate. So it's very difficult to actually shut down the program within whatever the dates they give us, okay, because it has been sort of phased out in some sense. And so I don't think the people who made this bill really understand how things work.
Hopefully we're all appreciative of the statement made by Provost Lee and our president with regards to that, which I think should go a long way toward allaying those anxieties, but the point's well made. It should be obvious to anyone that, you know, we have a very engaged board who is willing to have discussions that very substantive, and we have a lot of different talent around this table, as we've seen again today, and certainly I hope that is obvious to everyone. And Robin, I guess I'm sort of cutting you off here. I think you've answered a lot of questions, but I do want to, we have some calendar dates for everyone's attention here, and I want to suggest, particularly since we apparently have a little more ability to have a meeting with George in Washington, D.C., or wherever he may be, California, next week. We may want to consider some gathering in July, whereas the budget process and the strategic plan have to be married at some point. It's almost like a double helix. You've got to find the amino acids to connect all those. But I think perhaps some time in July we could orchestrate a meeting to where Freddie's point about being sure the board will be the body that approves the budget and the strategic plan. And we do want the board to feel like they've had every opportunity to participate and have their stamp on that. And we've had that during the process. Every board member has been on at least one of those committees. But as we move toward the end of the process, I think we may need to inject a July meeting in there somewhere so people can kind of think about that and maybe even later today or over the next week or two give me some indication whether early July, mid-July, but certainly before our August retreat on November 2nd. So I'll ask people to think about that if they will. The lunch is ready out there. They need everyone at the Student Union on the third floor no later than 1 o'clock. I'll entertain a motion for adjournment, although Randy, the committee meetings, I don't even have
to. You don't need a motion to adjourn if all
you know what? I'm going to adjourn this for lunch.